Welcome to the President's Inbox, a CFR podcast about the foreign policy challenges facing the United States. I'm Jim Lindsay, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Today's episode is a part of the Special Election 2020 series on the President's Inbox. In the run-up to the formal start of the Democratic nomination process, I'm sitting down with two experts with different views on how the United States should deal with the foreign policy challenges it faces. We hope that the contending views will give you a fuller understanding of what the candidates are and aren't saying on the campaign trail. This week's topic is China. With me to discuss what a sensible U.S. policy toward China would look like are Mira Rapp Hooper and Michael Swain. Mira Rapp Hooper is the Stephen A. Schwarzman Senior Fellow for Asia Studies at CFR. Her work focuses on national security issues in Asia, including great power competition and U.S. strategy toward China. She is also a senior fellow at Yale Law School's Paul Tsai China Center. She is the author of the forthcoming book, Shields of the Republic, The Triumph and Perils of America's Alliances, due out in June. Mira, thank you for joining me today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Jim.
Michael Swain is a senior fellow in the Asia program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He specializes in Chinese defense and foreign policy, U.S.-China relations, and East Asian international relations. Michael advises the U.S. government on Asia security issues and has written and edited more than a dozen books and monographs, including America's Challenge, Engaging a Rising China in the 21st Century. Michael, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you, Jim. Pleasure to be here.
Michael, I want to start with you, and I sort of want to do a scene setter a bit and really sort of talk about the evolution of U.S. policy toward China. How would you characterize or describe the policies that the United States has followed toward China, let's say since Jimmy Carter first granted formal recognition to Beijing?
Well, I think the United States, since that time, since basically normalization of relations, has followed a policy that has tried to merge or coordinate two different aspects. One of them has been what's called engagement, which is to try to engage China more deeply in the international system, to trade with China, to get China to adhere more to international norms and regulations of various types, and to have China benefit the global system and U.S. interests as well. At the same time, the United States has tried to engage in what's called hedging, which is developing the capabilities, economic, technological, military, et cetera, to remain able to deter China from doing certain things that the United States would not regard as being in its or its allies' interests regarding stability in Asia, for example, the Taiwan question, and other things. So over this time, there's been ups and downs. There's been retreats in terms of cooperation because of different issues and events that have occurred, the Tiananmen massacre in 1989, various incidents between the U.S. and China that have occurred militarily and otherwise that have led to sort of two steps forward, one step back. But overall, there has been a steady increase in the level of China's integration into the global system. There's been a steady increase in China's trade, trade with the United States in particular. Trade with the United States has increased by many, many fold since the U.S.-China relations began. And there's been a gradual increase by China in its acceptance of many of the norms and the regimes of the global order, with some important caveats and exceptions, of course.
Can you spell out just a bit, Michael, your sense of why the United States chose engagement? What assumptions was the engagement policy built upon?
I think the United States initially chose engagement for a couple of reasons. One of them was, of course, a strategic reason. The United States and the Soviet Union were the most critical contending powers in the international system at the time. And Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger believed that China, which had been really regarded as a kind of pariah by the United States, an outcast, and been pressured by the United States in many ways, confronted by the U.S., and China confronted the U.S. as well, that approach was no longer viable, that there needed to be an effort to try and open China up and to try and be able to work with China to balance against the Soviet Union at the time. That was a major motivation behind it. And then the second major motivation behind it was to try to open up China to the world so that China would eventually evolve and develop economically and to some extent socially and politically. And the desire there, of course, was to benefit from China's enormous growth, from China's enormous market, and to also get China again to try to adhere to some of the international norms and regulations of the global system, because after all, China was a huge proportion of the population of the world.
Mira, can I bring you in on this question? I mean, how would you assess the evolution of U.S. policy toward China, in particular looking at the assumptions those policy choices were based upon?
Yeah, Yeah, so I actually agree in large part with Michael's assessment here, Jim. And I think it's important to address these questions in the context that China watchers in Washington and elsewhere have been having over the course of the last few years, which is to say that a lot of the reason we're talking about the premises of engagement and what it has and has not delivered upon is because there's been a lot of concern amongst experts that the premises that guided these policies were somehow misguided. But as Michael indicated, I think the hopes that underpin engagement were actually relatively modest and have also been largely borne out. That is to say that China would become somewhat more open as it grew economically and became more embedded in the world, and that it would see itself as having a greater stake in the prevailing international order the more it became a part of it. Contrary to the assertions of some experts, I don't think American policymakers ever believed that China was likely to become a Jeffersonian democracy or thought that its membership in prevailing rules and institutions would erase some of the profound differences between it and the United States and its allies, but rather that these more modestly framed assumptions about the benefits to the world of engaging with China and to China in engaging with the world have actually been substantiated, at least in decent part.
Well, let me draw you out on that, Mira, because I don't think I'm giving away any secret here. The mood in Washington in terms of China policy is quite skeptical, indeed downright critical of, I would say, the last two, maybe three decades of practice. How would you assess the evolution of those views?
Well, I think there are sort of two separate things going on there, Jim, with respect to the current skepticism. That is to say, there is no question there's been a significant downturn in U.S.-China relations in the past few years. And with respect to the hardening on the U.S. side, I do think some of that is warranted. But that's different than saying that the premises that underpinned engagement for the last 40 years were fundamentally wrong. I might actually take a shorter view to what you just posed and argue that perhaps the last decade of U.S. policy towards China has come up a bit short or disappointed. In particular, since 2008, China's foreign policy has undeniably become more assertive, particularly so after Xi Jinping's rise to power. And I think we could make the case, I certainly would, that multiple U.S. administrations have missed the mark here. On the one hand, I think the Obama administration may have been a tiny bit more cautious than may have been warranted on some issues like the South China Sea, whereas we could argue that the Trump administration has been highly confrontational on trade, but sometimes to the detriment of broader strategy. But arguing that the United States has not necessarily hit the mark with respect to this more assertive China of the last few years is different than arguing that engagement itself has failed.
Michael, would you agree that China's become much more assertive or aggressive over the last decade?
Well, certainly, I think China has become more assertive, in some ways more aggressive. I think we have to be very clear about how we define these terms and what we mean by them. They are bandied about very easily by pundits in Washington and elsewhere. Generally, people tend to equate assertiveness with threats to American interests. The United States, for many, many years, encouraged China to be more assertive in a variety of different ways, economically, socially, politically, you name it. And the Chinese did become more assertive, more involved. I think the issue is, has China used its growing power, its growing presence, its growing economic military power to carry out policies vis-a-vis the United States, its allies, and vis-a-vis the global economy that threatens the interests of those entities? Is it more aggressive in doing that? And I think that is the nature of the problem in trying to assess China. Because in Washington, the assessment is, if you read the National Defense Strategy, National Security Strategy, is that it's extremely simple, very clear, and unambiguous. China is a revisionist global power that runs a predatory economy that's designed to overthrow the global order and replace the United States as the dominant power in the world.
Well, let me ask you, what is wrong with that diagnosis?
I think it's a cartoon. I think that in many respects, China has, as Mira suggested and I suggested, has supported and adhered to many aspects of the global order. Now, the global order is a big, complex entity. It's not just simply the United States, democracy, and freedom of speech. It includes a wide range of different types of behaviors, from dealing with pandemics to dealing with climate change, dealing with global financial order, all kinds of issues. And the United States and China's record on that is mixed. The United States has been supportive of the global order in some ways, and it has not in other ways. China, similarly, has been supportive of the global order in some ways and not in other ways. I think China has, in general, benefited enormously from the global order, particularly in the economic realm, since its entrance into the world stage. And I think that we have to be very clear about what we mean when we say China is more aggressive here, more aggressive there. I don't see it as seeking to wanting to fundamentally overturn the global order as we understand it and replace it with some kind of predatory, mercantilistic, and non-democratic order. I do think that in some ways it does pose challenges and concerns to the ability of the United States and its allies to be able to promote democracy around the world. I don't think China is a big supporter of liberal-style Western democracy. Then you have to get into the question of how strongly does China actually oppose it? Where would China go? What would it put at stake in order to try and advance those kinds of objectives? And then it becomes a much more complex question, because I don't think the Chinese really show much of it, that they're out to actively try to destroy democracies, undermine the democratic order such as it is in the world. So I think, as I say, we need to be very careful about how we define these kinds of terms.
Mira, Michael raised the issue of the U.S. national security strategy, so I want to give you a crack at it as well. How do you assess the diagnosis in the security strategy, particularly given, as Michael pointed out, it paints China as a competitor in a revisionist power that is acting against U.S. interests? Do you also see it as a cartoon?
Well, Jim, I do see it as certainly oversimplified. I would not go so far as to call it a cartoon. I do think that the United States and China are in a competition of a modern form. It's certainly taking forms and will continue to take shapes that we have not seen before. And it will continue, I think, to sort of shape shift. But I think it is far too simple to argue that China is some kind of monolithically revisionist power, as Michael suggested. That is to say, I do not see a China that is bent on wholesale overturning the so-called liberal international order in one fell swoop, nor do I see a China that has a singular alternative vision for order. I think there are a lot of problems with this diagnosis, not least the fact that it assumes the idea that China is outside of the existing international order, when in fact it is actually a member of almost every regime or institution in which it could possibly be a member. That is to say, it is very much inside the order. So to the extent that we're engaged in competition here, that competition is embedded in existing institutions, rules, and norms. But I would also argue that China's approach to prevailing order is highly variegated. It certainly seeks to leave its imprint on international order, not just by joining it, but also leading it in places. But in so doing, I think it's pursuing a mixed strategy that is not at all just sort of one clear set of agenda items for the entire international system. I think in some global institutions, such as with respect to its voting shares at the IMF or its participation in the UN, it's seeking to make sure that its representation is commensurate with its power. And that's not a bad thing. That's what we should expect and hope for from a rising power. I think that in some areas, it's seeking to build alternative institutions that reflect its perceived regional stature. And there I'm thinking about the Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank or the Belt and Road Initiative, which of course we can talk about in more detail. I think in areas where there are fewer rules and norms that we might call undergoverned spaces, as on the internet or on cyberspace, China's seeking to build new rules that reflect its preferences. And in select cases, mostly on issues of regional security, it's seeking to exercise what it sees as a major power's prerogative to flout rules and norms without replacing them. So I see those types of behaviors on issues like the South China Sea. Of course, there are also problematic behaviors in areas like human rights, where not only has China sort of hamstrung the Human Rights Council, but by virtue of its own practices in Xinjiang, has run up headlong against human rights norms in the international system. But to suggest that there's any one diagnosis for this behavior, I think is far too simplistic.
Okay, so Mary, you and Michael have both put an awful lot of specific substantive issues on the table. And I know that if you're on the staff of the National Security Council, you look at these and it's a year's worth of work because lots of different issues. So let's take a moment and sort of drill down. You both allowed that at a minimum on some issues, China and the United States are not on the same page, that our interests are antagonistic or in conflict. So I guess, Michael, if I may, sort of as you look at it, what are the issues you would put in that basket of conflicting, not easily reconcilable issues or policies?
Well, I think probably from my perspective as a security specialist, probably the most troublesome difference between the United States and China is their perception about what best preserves order and stability, particularly in the Western Pacific.
Okay, in the Western Pacific is what?
The Western Pacific I would define as probably everything west of Hawaii and everything east of the Indian Ocean.
Okay.
And I think there, I mean, the United States for over 70 years has basically pursued security policies in this region on the basis of the idea that American military predominance, America's ability to prevail, America's ability to operate freely all throughout this area has preserved the peace and provided the kind of environment that has allowed other countries to prosper. And I think to a great extent, this has been the case with some exceptions. I think the Chinese increasingly, they do not accept that assumption. They believe that Asia can best prosper by having a more balanced system, that it's becoming more multipolar in any event, that China needs to reduce its vulnerability to the ability of the United States to operate freely in its approaches because of its own security concerns, and that therefore China is establishing what is in effect a parity with American power in the Western Pacific. And it's developed a range of military capabilities there that really call into question the ability of the United States to operate with impunity in that area. So the question is, how do you deal with that problem? Because over time, what's going to happen is as you become more and more equal in capability and influence, the two sides begin to become less certain about exactly who has leverage over certain types of issues. And there are potentially volatile issues in the Western Pacific, as we know, from Korea to Taiwan, the South China Sea, etc. So you have the danger in this situation that the United States, with the idea that it's being seen as losing its relative influence, that relative to that of China, overreacts to what it sees as Chinese over-assertiveness or overconfidence, which China, by its own token, says, well, I have more capability, therefore I'm more willing to take certain risks.
I'm curious, Michael, you used the word parity, and I'm struck by that because, as you know, a lot of people in this debate would argue that China isn't looking for parity, it is looking for dominance. It views the Western Pacific as naturally its neighborhood, and it wants to dominate. Is that argument wrong?
To be honest, I don't think we really can say for sure what the objective of China is. How China looks at the Western Pacific in terms of its position and that of the United States as absolutely essential to its security. Does it regard dominance, its own dominance, as absolutely essential to being able to retain its own security? I think that's an open question. I don't think the Chinese currently have that as a clear, unambiguous strategic objective.
So you wouldn't read in the fact that the Chinese have taken over islands in the South China Sea and militarize them?
No, I don't.
Send a clear signal that they intend to?
I don't think you can ipso facto draw a straight line conclusion from that and say, well, the Chinese are obviously out to dominate the whole region and throw the U.S. out, which many people are doing exactly that. I just think that their position in the South China Sea reflects a lot of their own nationalist orientation, their views towards sovereignty and what they think the right of a sovereign nation is. Yes, they have views that others reject in terms of their disputes about the South China Sea. There's arguments as to who has the better argument over who owns what areas in that region or what land in that region. But the problem is, does the United States regard this as a fundamental threat to its basic position? And if so, how does it respond to that threat? My argument is that the United States is not going to resolve this by doubling down and trying to stay well ahead of the Chinese because I think it's unrealistic. It's likely not to be feasible. It could provoke developments that would otherwise be avoidable. And the Chinese aren't going to accept it anyway. So you're going to get into an open-ended arms race in the Western Pacific of military capabilities with a China that is still growing at quite high levels and investing a lot in its military. We have to think more about how exactly we can maintain order in this kind of system. And my argument has been we need to establish a more stable balance between China and the United States and its allies. Not a classic 19th century sort of balance, but one that really does have certain types of assumptions underlying it between the two sides as to where restraint should be in their operations in the Western Pacific and where they can cooperate effectively in ways that can reassure each other and not just deter each other.
Mira, how do you assess Chinese intentions in the Western Pacific?
Well, similarly, my primary concern about where U.S. and Chinese interests may not be aligned falls upon these regional security issues in the Western Pacific. I share Michael's view, actually, that it is unrealistic for the United States to scramble to try to preserve military primacy in the Western Pacific. In fact, I fear that that is already a day that has passed us by as China moves very quickly to close the balance of power, at least in local quantitative terms, meaning that if we count individual ships that are deployed in the region, individual platforms, the United States and China are quickly approaching parity in the region. But I nonetheless think there are a lot of questions that remain open. Chiefly, as Michael pointed to, there is this question of what are China's requirements for its own role in the region? What does that mean for the United States? That is to say, does China's vision for reestablishing itself as a regional leader require it to push the United States out of Asia? Or can the United States remain a strong Pacific power so long as it is also prepared to live with a stronger China in Asia? Including a militarily stronger China. If the latter is the case, then I think it is possible to establish a stable balance of power in the Western Pacific. But if China's vision requires it to expunge American military power and unravel American alliances in Asia, then I fear that our interests are very much in conflict in ways that could make for a rather dark next few decades. The darker view is presented, of course, if one considers China's emphasis on so-called anti-access area denial capabilities and strategies, mostly reliant on missiles, sensors, and other technologies that it deploys primarily across from Taiwan in an effort to dissuade Taiwan from mounting any kind of bid for independence, but also in an effort to dissuade the United States from coming to the aid of any of its allies inside the first island chain. That is to say, the chain of archipelagos that sweeps all the way down through Korea, Japan, the Philippines, and all the way down to Australia, which has been the United States' primary forward line of defense in the region. So to the extent that China's vision for the Western Pacific requires it to push the United States back such that it can't defend its allies, and to the extent that the United States remains intent on doing so, we have quite a potentially sporting set of dynamics on our hands that could be very problematic indeed.
Mira, I know Michael wants to get in this, but I just want to ask you a very short question is, how would you answer those questions you just posed? Because obviously in making policy, you have to make decisions about what you think the other country's goals, interests, ambitions are.
So I think that the United States can both remain in Asia and live with a stronger China. And I certainly hope that Chinese...
So you don't think the Chinese want dominance in the region?
I think the Chinese may very well want dominance, but whether they're willing to settle for something less is a different question. And I think the answer to that could very possibly be yes.
Okay. Michael, I know you wanted to jump in here.
Well, no. I mean, I agree very much with what Mira just said. I was just going to say that we have to remember that to the extent to which the Chinese do or do not believe that they need to push the United States out of Asia relies on what the United States itself says and does. I tend to look at the Chinese, I look at any country, as measuring its interests in a very contingent way. You have certain bedrock interests, but then how you achieve those interests, how you attain those goals is somewhat fungible. And I think that if we continue to regard the Chinese as a kind of zero-sum opponent, that we continue to sort of act as if the Chinese acquiring greater capabilities in various areas, military, economic, and other, are by definition a threat to the United States, we're in for trouble. Sure, we will get a confrontational environment where the stakes will become very high for both sides, and the kind of policies that they adopt will become extreme, and they will rule out all kinds of other efforts to try and moderate behavior. I think that the United States, I agree with Mira, the United States, or China rather, can live with a situation where the United States remains strong in the Western Pacific. I mean, let's not fool ourselves. The U.S. is not going to depart from the Western Pacific. We're not about to withdraw from that region. We're not about to give up our allies. And these countries are strong, independent countries with strong economies, for the most part, and the United States has very strong values and interests with these states. They're not about to run towards the Chinese either, but we don't want to have to force them to make a choice. We don't want to make the Japanese, for example, give up their economic interactions with China, which are deep and extensive, in order to support a zero-sum strategy towards Beijing that the United States might want to see. I think that is a losing strategy for the United States.
I want to shift gears a moment on this issue and talk about something else where U.S. interests and China's interests may or may not be aligned, and that is a topic that you raised a moment ago, Mira, the Belt and Road Initiative. As I, as a non-expert on China, read it, I am either presented with the Belt and Road Initiative as this master plan to make all roads run to Beijing, enabling China to use its sort of economic gravitational pull to bend others to its will. On the other hand, I read articles that talk about the Belt and Road Initiative is overblown, talk about debt trap diplomacy, or are stories that are taken out of context or exaggerated. How do you assess what China is up to with the Belt and Road Initiative?
Well, Jim, I think it's a very difficult topic to assess, and that is at least in part by Chinese design. That is to say that Belt and Road is an initiative, a signature initiative for Xi Jinping, which was first rolled out in 2013, has since been enshrined in the Chinese constitution and is by no means going anywhere anytime soon. But its definition, even in CCP documents, changes by the year. And depending on which speech or which document you're reading, the contents of the initiative can vary widely. So it shouldn't surprise us that according to some analysts, this is a master plan. And according to others, it's an initiative that is already encountering substantial political blowback. And I think in all likelihood, there is some truth to all of this analysis. And it's a picture that will just continue to emerge over the years to come. That is to say that when it comes to what China's projects mean for countries overseas, the picture is very mixed. There are only a handful of countries at most that we could point to as having encountered real debt traps. And those are countries where there tended to be major economic frailties that preceded China's involvement in the country itself. There are many other countries where poorly administered projects have led to adverse outcomes. And there are more countries still where there have been some positive development results for the target countries in question. And I would say that when it comes to U.S. interests, the Belt and Road is probably similarly complex. That is to say, there are probably some areas of Belt and Road, vast as it is, where China's initiatives should worry us. There, I'm thinking about things like the Digital Silk Road, which is part of China's push to lay down digital infrastructure all across the world, which has led to some of the controversies over Huawei and 5G deployments. I am concerned as well about China's potential acquisition of port facilities all over the world, which could become dual-use ports with military purposes, but even if they don't, could pose security risks. But there's also areas in which I think the United States probably has less reason to be concerned. That is to say, if China succeeds in building roads and bridges in parts of Central or South Asia, where the United States was not particularly active in the first place, and manages to raise development levels such that those countries become better able to work with U.S. companies or with other multilateral development institutions, it's not clear to me that that's problematic for U.S. interests. So part of the upshot of this initiative being so sprawling and ill-defined, I think, is that we should also expect the outcomes to be similarly complex.
Michael, how do you assess Belt and Road, but also that related issue that Mira brought up about Huawei and the efforts of the U.S. government to pressure, convince America's friends and allies not to buy parts from Huawei?
Well, I agree with much of what Mira's just said about the Belt and Road. I think it's a much more complex phenomenon than it's depicted as being. I think the idea of debt trap diplomacy as a deliberate, concerted, systematic, consistent Chinese strategy designed to draw countries into debt so that they will default and the Chinese will be able to seize assets and thereby take control over countries is, I'm sorry to say it again, a cartoon. It does not reflect the reality of China's involvement with these countries. Yes, many of them have been dragged into or developed into areas of excessive debt, but it's been in part because of their own mistakes as much as what the Chinese have done. In many cases, as I understand it, Chinese entities, banking entities, corporations have been very, let's say, not entirely professional in the way in which they've pursued their interests in some of these countries because they've been pushed and they have encouraged the idea that this is a big campaign that Xi Jinping is identified with so that they want to see good results so that they will take more risks less than they otherwise should do. The point here is that the United States doesn't present the Belt and Road Initiative in this way at all. It presents the Belt and Road Initiative as a concerted strategy designed by China to take over these countries. And that is just simply not borne out by the entirety of the evidence, as far as I can see. I think what the Belt and Road Initiative needs is standards. It needs better feasibility capabilities. It needs international standards. It needs an oversight body that will be able to bring in expertise from the outside, much the same as the Chinese have done with the Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank, where everybody initially said, or the Americans did primarily, oh my God, this is a gigantic threat to us. We can't let this go on. In fact, the Chinese opened this bank up to international standardization. It brought in a board of overseers involved with foreigners involved in overseeing this bank. It has in many ways turned out to be quite a positive institution. I'm not saying the Belt and Road will follow exactly that kind of course, but I think we should not be just simply precluding it to begin with as some kind of nefarious Chinese plot to take over the world. We should in fact be involved in the Belt and Road as much as we can. We should both compete with it and also be involved in it. Now, on the Huawei issue, that is a very complicated issue, and I am not in any way competent to make assessments about technological issues. I tend to lean in the direction of the argument that the United States and other countries should develop high walls around a narrow area. We should define clearly what constitutes national security threats to our technology from a technological point of view, define it as clearly as we can in concert with our friends and allies and not overriding them and against their own interests, and then move forward to try and get a broad agreement within the international system in this area and proceed on that basis and not act as if the Chinese, by definition, are out to undermine Western technology. Because the problem here is that we can end up in a bifurcated technological environment where the Chinese have their own sets of standards and procedures and the United States has its own. And I'm not entirely sure that other countries around the world are necessarily going to follow the U.S. They could, in many cases, very well lean towards the Chinese.
Talking like essentially having two different operating systems.
Yeah, in which case the United States could end up isolating itself more than it actually hives off the Chinese. And there, I think there has to be a much, much better recognition of how technology actually works in the world. It's not the case where a national leadership controls technology strongly, is able to determine how it's going to evolve, how you develop new innovative technologies, etc. It's a much more diffuse, much more diverse, much more complex process that involves a huge amount of back and forth between scientists, technicians, etc. at all different levels.
I want to look forward now and sort of talk about what U.S. policy should be. Now, obviously, we can talk about a U.S.-China policy, but under that chapeau come lots of things, whether we're talking about economics and trade, whether we're talking about security, whether we're talking about human rights. Maybe I'll begin with you, Merit. What would you think, or how would you describe the policy that you think the United States should be following in dealing with China?
Jim, when it comes to what our policy should be towards China, I think we have to start by asking ourselves, what are our objectives in the world that China may run up against, may make it harder to secure? And what strategy could we put in place that would allow us to secure them? I see our objectives here as seeking to guarantee American security and prosperity while preparing ourselves to live alongside a stronger China that's likely to be with us for many decades to come. As I write with my colleague Rebecca Listener in our forthcoming book, the United States should be seeking to keep the international system open, both regionally and functionally, to ensure that the world can remain largely interdependent. That is to say, to ensure that China's rise does not result in it establishing closed or hierarchical blocks, either in parts of Asia, Eurasia, or in functional domains like in technology. But it may surprise your listeners to know that I think at least 50% of this agenda, if not more, is domestic. That is to say that when it comes to securing American prosperity, that's largely going to be determined in the United States and not by China. So a lot of this policy depends on focusing on those areas that will keep us innovative and our economy resilient and dynamic, regardless of what China does. So there I'm thinking of things like bigger investments in education, STEM and K-12. I'm thinking about restoring government levels of R&D to their historic norms. I'm thinking about working to correct correct the massive incentives gaps between Washington and Silicon Valley so that American technological prowess actually complements the national interest. But I also am thinking of sort of more traditional aspects of foreign policy that you might expect to hear enumerated with respect to a strategy towards China. I do believe the United States lacks but needs a credible defense strategy for the first island chain archipelago, as Michael and I were discussing with respect to these tensions in the Western Pacific. If Washington is to remain a credible security guarantor and to credibly be able to defend its allies and keep the waters of the Western Pacific parts of the global commons, it will need to be able to demonstrate a defense strategy that can secure those ends. I think that also depends on modernizing our alliances, which is an agenda that I lay out in my forthcoming book, which requires us to think about how alliances can focus outside of the nuclear and conventional military domains to wrestle with some of the challenges that we're most likely to be facing in the coming decades. It also includes a regional trade agenda, a global technology strategy, which requires us to cooperate with our allies on some of these 5G and other new technology issues that we were just discussing, and to align our efforts to ensure that China is not the sole architect of information infrastructure in areas that are most sensitive. But ultimately, because our interests are not exclusively zero sum, as we've been discussing, I see a sensible American strategy as one that should first and foremost be a charge to be the 21st century great power we should want to be, regardless of China, but a charge that becomes all the more important because of China's ascent.
That's an awful lot of stuff to put on the table, Mira. And I would imagine for a number of people listening are going to say, that's a lot of priorities. And if everything is a priority, then nothing is a priority. So in your own sort of sense of thinking about U.S. policy, which of those objectives would you put at the top and which would you be willing to sacrifice?
It's always a great question, Jim. To my mind, the domestic components here are actually the most important. I think we've seen evidence in China's own strategy that the CCP is somewhat opportunistic. That is to say that its own strategy has reacted to perceived weaknesses in the United States, perceived windows and moments of opportunity. And I think a push in the United States to reinvest in itself by way of education and technology policy might be the most powerful thing we could do to stabilize the balance of power in Asia. That said, I think that a lot of these policies that I've just laid out here actually have to remain in play. We could certainly put climate change on the agenda as one of the other defining foreign policy challenges of our time, but there's no question that if we are to put in place a holistic China strategy, it's going to have to be really comprehensive and require considerable commitment of resources.
Michael,
you're not getting a whole lot of disagreement here, Jim.
That's all right. But I mean, as you were to sketch out a U.S. policy, what would you want to emphasize?
I mean, I go to the same things that Mira goes to. I think the United States itself has to begin with thinking hard about how it's going to really compete in the 21st century, how it's going to improve its ability to invest in those areas that are absolutely critical for America's competitive capability, as Mira suggested, in STEM research, in supporting certain types of technology development. The United States doesn't do nearly enough of that as a government. We tend to have this very simplistic idea of what industrial policy is, as if all countries are engaged in some kind of state intervention in industry, and we are not. We engage in it as well. The question is, do we do it in an effective way? Do we do it in a way that is generally in concert with that of other countries? And how do we get other countries to pull into line with what would be standard norms? I mean, the World Trade Organization is supposed to be an entity that does that sort of thing. It has worked, I would say, to a mixed extent in achieving some of these things. The United States needs to think hard about how to revise that entity, how to encompass technological issues within the WTO more effectively, and to improve the arbitration system and the decision-making process for conflict resolution in the WTO. But it also has to focus on how to improve America's own capabilities internally, infrastructure and otherwise. The second thing that I think is really important is I think that the United States has to really make a decision about where it wants to go in Asia, what its presence is there. It needs to improve its economic game in the region enormously. My My colleague at Carnegie, Evan Feigenbaum, has written about this quite a bit, and I agree very much with his criticisms of the U.S. in falling short in its activities in Asia economically, and it needs to really increase that. It needs to do the same thing on the defense side, for sure. But there, I see the objective not one of, as we've said before, trying to attain or sustain predominance, but one of trying to establish a balance based upon denial capabilities, more defensive-oriented denial capabilities that each side does not directly threaten the other side's most vital security interests, including the interests of American allies. I think that's possible to do, but I don't think we're going to do it on the basis of the trajectories that we're currently seeing between the United States and China. So, I mean, I would point to a lot of the same things that Mira points to. I think we have to take another look at the Trans-Pacific Partnership in the region.
Do you think it was a mistake for the Trump administration to have left the TPP?
To have categorically rejected it? Yes, I do. I think the Japanese and others have gone ahead without us.
Why do you think it was a mistake?
Because I think it offered the potential, if it could be adjusted correctly and deal with some labor concerns that do exist, it offered the potential for establishing a higher level of standards in economic behavior across Asia that would have facilitated greater trade and investment among countries that eventually would have then pulled the Chinese. It would have gotten the Chinese to feel that they need to alter some of their behaviors in order to comply more effectively with a system that was surpassing them or going by them. Instead, it's the other way around now. The Regional Comprehensive Economic Program that the Chinese are deeply involved in is moving forward, and the Japanese are moving forward with the TPP. So the United States is really putting itself outside of this process, and it shouldn't be doing that.
What do you say to people who complain that China has not competed fairly in international economics, particularly with its theft of intellectual property around the world, but particularly from the United States, and point to China 2025 as a threat to the American industrial and technological base?
With all of these criticisms, or at least most of these criticisms, there is a grain of truth to the criticisms. The Chinese certainly have stolen technology. They're not in any way unique in that respect. The United States was a major technology thief when it was coming up as a power, but China is doing
it today.
But today
you can steal a lot more a lot quicker.
You can steal a lot more a lot quicker. And part of the problem is China's big and it's very capable. So that creates a big issue for it. But, you know, I think that we have to have tougher ways of being able to negotiate on technology questions, to be able to define what is and is not technology thievery and what areas. And we have to become more realistic about exactly how serious this issue is. As some observers like Larry Summers have said.
Former Secretary of the Treasury.
Right. He said that it can't be argued seriously that unfair Chinese trade practices have affected U.S. growth by even 0.1% per year. Now, that just suggests that, yes, we have these problems. Yes, we need to deal with them. But they are not the kind of do-or-die issues on trade, investment, et cetera, that is going to measure whether or not the United States is going to remain a capable economic power in the future or not.
Mira, a topic that both you and Michael have raised is allies and the role of allies. Since you have a book coming out on allies, I really want to put this question to you, which is, where do America's allies, its friends, its partners stand on this? And I will note that at least some of our traditional allies and friends and partners feel cross-pressured. I will note that the poster child here may be Australia, for whom the United States is the security guarantor, but obviously China is the number one market for their exports. So how are our allies dealing with being cross-pressured, and what is the policy that the United States should pursue to keep them on board?
Jim, there's no question that our allies feel cross-pressured, and I would argue that each of our allies feels different cross-pressures in different ways in different moments. I think there is no single ally that hasn't or doesn't feel that at some point. So the question is not whether our allies will have to find ways to be able to continue to have economic and political relationships with China while still having very close security relationships with the United States. But what does that look like? I think in particular, since the United States has become more unpredictable in the eyes of its allies in the region in the last few years, you've seen even some of its very closest partners in Asia, namely Japan, whose interests are most closely aligned with the United States, hedge by increasing its diplomatic and economic ties with China even further. So we can sort of dash the notion that there is ever going to be a world in which U.S. allies don't find themselves deeply interdependent with China. For the United States, I think that augurs towards pursuing a strategy where we start by asking our allies what they would like to see from a stable and secure Asia. It's, you know, a set of conversations we've had for a long time, but I think one that needs to be renewed in the face of a lot of American unpredictability in the region, from, you know, pulling out of TPP to the trade war and many other policies. And from there, crafts allied-specific approaches to what it means for those countries to be able to have the relationships with China that they already do while remaining close defense partners of the United States. As I discuss in my book and won't belabor here, I think a lot of that agenda involves looking beyond what has traditionally been the purview of American defense alliances, which is to say that our alliance system in Asia, wildly successful though it has been, was crafted to deter the Soviet Union from the possibility of nuclear or conventional military attacks. Yet so much of what we've been talking about on this episode today involves competition in other areas, in the maritime domain, in the technology domain, in the areas that are likely to feel perhaps the most heated, but fall significantly below the Article 5 or mutual defense provisions of all of these security treaties. So to my mind, the agenda forward with America's allies is to start by figuring out what it looks from their perspective to live in a world with a stronger China and a close defense relationship with the United States, and then proceed by reorienting our alliances towards increasingly symmetric burden sharing, contingent on the idea that we have this whole range of other activities that we're going to need to engage if we are to be successful allies out into the future in this world with a stronger China.
Michael, I know you may want to weigh on this question of allies, but I'd also like to just get your thoughts on where human rights should fall in U.S. foreign policy. Earlier on, you mentioned the oppression of Uyghurs in Xinjiang. Is human rights something that the United States should make a priority in its relations with China, or is it, as many people have argued, an issue that we should look past because our ability to influence Beijing's behavior is limited?
I don't think the United States can ever look past the issue of human rights. I think the United States rightly stands for certain types of human, social, and political rights that it should, in fact, stand as a model for. And I don't see it doing that to a whole degree. It should do it more effectively than it is today, in part because of its own behavior. I think, though, the United States has to be realistic about our strengths and our limitations. And we need to be in line with what other countries, other democracies, feel comfortable doing as much as possible. We should press the Chinese on the observance of their own agreements and their own laws about how they treat their own people. And we shouldn't do stupid things. For example, we shouldn't be implying support for violent protest in Hong Kong. Peaceful protest, yes. Violent protest, no. And we shouldn't be giving the impression, as some politicians have on the Hill, that we're in favor of Hong Kong independence, which is never going to happen. And if it ever did, it would happen as a result of a conflagration the United States does not want to see. And we have to improve, as I said a minute ago, our attractiveness to other countries, both allies and non-allies. And I think we've not been doing a good job of that at all.
I want to ask one closing question about the issue that is dominating the news right now, and that is the coronavirus that originated in Wuhan and which has seemed to have taken hold in China and has crossed boundaries. Do you see this, Mira, as a game changer? Is it going to have longer-term systemic consequences, in particular affecting how people in the region view China?
In all likelihood, Jim, I think it is not going to. There is no question that it is dominating the headlines now, and for very good reason. But there is also reason to believe that a lot of the policies that we're seeing right now, shutting down travel, quarantines, etc., may not be entirely fit to the task. That is, we don't really know their efficacy when up against a problem like this. But unless, of course, the very worst occurs and they escalate from there, they tend not to completely reset politics or geopolitics. And it's certainly my hope that this outbreak will come under control within the coming weeks. And therefore not change the geopolitical picture or U.S.-China relations.
I want to give you a chance to answer the question as well, Michael. I should say part of the reason I ask about it is because we're hearing a lot of talk about the impact this could potentially have on the Chinese economy, leading to a slowdown. What kind of challenges would that present to Xi Jinping, who has sort of solidified his role as the person who makes decisions in China? So do you see this having systemic consequences?
I think it's really too early to tell. I rather doubt it. I think that the Chinese system thus far has dealt with this problem reasonably well, although there's been local activities that have occurred that have been sort of denying or limiting information too heavily. And I think the Chinese system in general inclines towards doing that. But I think the important thing right now is that other countries need to recognize what does and does not work in trying to deal with the coronavirus. I think there's some strong arguments to say that trying to put these wholesale travel bans on China or the Chinese is not really going to be very productive. In fact, it could very well be counterproductive. If this virus does really take off, if it becomes much worse than the SARS virus did and other similar viruses, avian flu and such, then you could see some very serious repercussions for the Chinese system, I think. But I don't think it's going to get that serious.
On that note, I'll close up this special election 2020 episode of The President's Inbox. My guests have been Meera Rapp Hooper, Senior Fellow for Asia Studies here at the Council on Foreign Relations, and Michael Swain, Senior Fellow in the Asia Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Meera and Michael, thank you for joining me for today's conversation.
Thank you, Jim.
Thanks, Jim.
I have posted links to what Meera, Michael, and others have written about China on my blog, The Water's Edge. You can find the blog at CFR.org. Again, that's The Water's Edge on CFR.org. If you are not already subscribing to The President's Inbox, I hope you would consider doing so. You can subscribe to it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Whichever podcast service you use, I also hope you would leave us a review, as well as your suggestions for what topics to cover. Your feedback helps us improve the show. As always, opinions expressed in The President's Inbox are solely those of the host or our guests, not a CFR, which takes no institutional positions. Today's episode was produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlick. Anthony LeBarry and Luis Gomez were our recording engineers. Special thanks to Margaret Gatch for her assistance. This episode of The President's Inbox was made possible in part by a grant from the Carnegie Corporation of New York. This is Jim Lindsay. Thanks for listening.